Welcome to Beyond the Bench, the podcast produced by the North Carolina Judicial College at the UNC School of Government. I'm your host, Jeff Welty, the director of the North Carolina Judicial College and a faculty member here at the school. Our goal is to bring you interesting interviews with people who work in or with the court system, including judges, lawyers, academics, and others. This first season of Beyond the Bench focuses on criminal justice. On today's show, we have two segments. First, my colleague, Professor John Rubin, interviews Superior Court Judge Marianne Talley. Judge Talley was one of the first public defenders in the state and had a long and interesting career in indigent defense before taking the bench. I think you'll enjoy the discussion. Then, after a break, I talk with Professor Shay Denning about the law of distracted driving. We'll cover burning questions like, can you text while stopped at a red light? And is it okay to watch your iWatch while you drive? Some of the answers may surprise you. Also, be sure to stay tuned at the end of the podcast to hear a bit about what we have in store for our next episode. Without further ado, enjoy the first interview.
This is John Rubin from the School of Government. I'm here at the Cumberland County Courthouse with Judge Marianne Talley. Thanks for helping us kick off our inaugural podcasts.
Glad to help.
Judge Talley was kind enough to send me her resume ahead of time. I'm going to tell you a few things about her background. She's had a long and illustrious career, but perhaps most noteworthy is, for many people in North Carolina, if you say you're going to talk to Marianne, they know exactly who you're talking about. And being recognized on a first name basis shows the impact she's had over the years. Marianne has now has been Superior Court Judge in the 12th Judicial District in Cumberland County since 2011. She was the Director of the Trials Assistance Unit at the Center for Death Penalty Litigation. She was a commissioner for 8 years on the Commission for Indigent Defense Services, General Counsel, North Carolina Academy of Trial Lawyers. But I want to go back even further. When I first met Marianne, when she was the public defender for Cumberland County. Now, that Cumberland County public defender, that was one of the first public defender offices in the state.
There were two offices established by the legislature, and the first office that was up and running was Guilford County. And then Cumberland County, well, the 12th Judicial District was the second. At the time, it was Cumberland and Hope counties together.
And you were one of the first public defenders in the state.
Well, I was the fourth public defender. Wally Harrelson was the first public defender in Guilford County.
Often referred to himself as the oldest rat in the barn.
Yes. And the first public defender in the 12th District was Saul Cherry, who became the chief district court judge later. The next public defender was Jimmy Little. And I was appointed by Governor Holzhauser after Jimmy Little decided to go into private practice. I was the first female public defender, chief public defender.
I have your resume. You graduated from Duke Law School in 1974, and then you went right into work as a public defender. What drew you to indigent defense and the public defender's office in particular?
A job. Actually, when I got out of Duke Law School, I thought I wanted to be an international lawyer, but I had met my husband in law school, and he was from Fayetteville, wanted to move back to Fayetteville, and I found out there wasn't going to be too much international law on the Cape Fear River. But my husband told me all the good lawyers to write to ask for a job, the reputable people, and I got no job interviews. And I got one letter back that said they had all the secretaries they needed at the moment, but would let me know if an opening arose. And so I was so discouraged. But my mother-in-law suggested that I talk to Jimmy Little, who was the public defender. Well, I didn't know anything about it at all. But surprisingly, I interviewed with Jimmy, and he offered me a job, and that was how I got into the public defender's office.
I don't think I realized until I looked at your resume that you became the public defender after 2 years.
18 months.
after graduating law school, well, after starting as a public defender.
That's right. And, of course, there were a lot of local attorneys that I had to convince that I could do the job because I was very young. But I got a lot of local support, and then back then, the governor appointed public defenders. And so I was appointed in June of 76 by then Governor Jim Holzhauser.
Now this was, geez, barely 10 years after Gideon v. Wainwright and the recognition of a constitutional right to have counsel appointed if you were too poor to hire one. And we only had the two public defender offices. What was it like back in those wild, woolly days?
Scrappy was what it was like. Of course, back then, there was no discovery. And you just had to do the best you could with what you had. But I ended up being so fortunate that we were able to attract some of the best and the brightest people here to work in the public defender's office in Fayetteville. People like Greg Weeks, who is a retired Superior Court judge. Ty Hunter, who was the appellate defender and then head of IDS. Staples Hughes, who became the appellate defender. Jim Parrish, just an excellent attorney here in Fayetteville. Ed Pone, who's a district court judge here in Fayetteville. Fred Williams, who was a Superior Court judge and now teaches at Central Law School. Mike Ofalu, who is a Superior Court judge from Durham. I mean, the talent that we had here was amazing. And we helped each other. And there was never a day that went by that somebody wouldn't ask somebody else in the office, I've got this problem, this legal issue. Can you help me? And so we did that. And every night we came back to this office after supper and worked on our cases for as long as it took. It was just an amazing group of people to work with.
So you've been involved in the courts and criminal justice system for your entire legal career. Thinking about indigent defense, what do you see as the most significant changes that have occurred in North Carolina in particular?
That's an easy question to answer. The most important and significant change was the establishment of Indigent Defense Services. It's something that a number of us worked on for years. I served on the Legislative Study Commission, and I was on the IDS Commission. IDS became a model for the country because IDS was established as an independent agency. And this was according to the standards of the ABA and all of the recommendations concerning indigent defense, that there be independence so that the lawyers representing people in indigent cases would have the freedom and the autonomy to advocate for their clients without being worried about some judge looking over their shoulder or
like,
taking
like
their
you
job
now.
And like me. And so that's clearly the most significant step in indigent defense. As a part of that, really the first step that IDS took was to try to get a hold of capital cases. That was incredibly significant because there were so many problems with indigent defense in capital cases. And to have established what IDS did with the capital defender, with standards for capital defense attorneys, with training, with consultation, that was a huge step, and it has made a huge difference in North Carolina.
Thinking about indigent defenders, criminal defense attorneys and indigent defenders in particular, what qualities or attributes do you think make for an excellent indigent defender?
Somebody who cares. The thing about indigent defense is, I used to laugh, this was more true before the establishment of INDS than it is now, but I used to laugh and say, you know, you have to do everything with nothing. You have no resources, you have no help, but you have to do everything. And really good indigent defenders have to be dedicated to the proposition that their clients are going to get the kind of service that a person would get if that person had $1 million to pay for their defense. And I think they really have to be dedicated to that proposition. And when I say you care, I mean, I think you have to come to an understanding of the humanity of the clientele. There are people who make awful mistakes. There are people who commit horrendous offenses, but they are human beings. And I think the best offenders can understand that underlying humanity and find that and attempt to express that in some way in court.
So now you're a judge. How has being a judge informed, changed, affected your thoughts about indigent defense? It's a different perspective than when you were an advocate.
It is a different perspective, but I see the importance of a really strong adversary system. There just simply is no justice unless there is effective advocacy on both sides of a prosecution. Sometimes it bothers me when a lawyer doesn't know anything about his client, and I find out more at a plea hearing from talking to the client than the lawyer has been able to tell me. One of the other things that I think lawyers need to be aware of is that they need to understand that they need to advocate not only for a particular result or a particular sentence, but they need to look at the whole issue of sentencing and what they're doing to the clients, and can they make a difference? For example, there are so many clients who are burdened with huge court costs, fees, and fines, and it just sets them up for failure because there's no way that they can pay that money. Now, of course, since the advent of the Justice Reinvestment Act, fortunately, in my view, those people can't be sent to prison. Now, I never would have sent them to prison anyway because I don't think we should be running a debtor's prison in this state or any other state. But it is incredibly burdensome, and I think that lawyers really need to pay attention to that when they're advocating in front of the court, because I think there are many judges who are like me that if it's called to their attention, they would remit some of those monies so that the clients are not set up for failure on probation from day one.
It is wonderful to get a chance to talk to you. I hope you have no plans to retire anytime soon, but I suppose we all reach that point at some stage.
Well, I told Judicial Standards that I'm announcing my candidacy for 2018.
Well, I am delighted to hear it, and I appreciate your taking time out of your busy schedule to help us with these inaugural podcasts. I will give you the last word.
Well, I appreciate the opportunity to have this interview, and I also want to say that the School of Government is such a wonderful resource for the judicial system, and I can only speak for the judicial system. I can't speak for county commissioners or other people, but it's a unique resource, and the School of Government has been an incredible help to me not only when I was the public defender, but also now that I'm on the bench. And so I'm grateful for the school and the resources it provides.
Thank you very much, and thank you for your time today.
This is your host, Jeff Welty, back again. That concludes John Rubin's interview with Judge Talley, but that's not all we have to offer today. In the second segment of this episode, I talk with Shay Denning about distracted driving. Vroom, vroom, here we go. Welcome back to Beyond the Bench. In the second segment of today's episode, I'm going to be talking with my colleague Shay Denning about distracted driving and the laws that we have regulating distracted driving in North Carolina. Shay, thanks for participating.
Glad to be here.
Awesome. So, as I mentioned, our topic is criminal laws regulating distracted driving, and folks who follow the news will know that the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Department of Transportation and the CDC have all identified distracted driving as a serious problem. Some of the statistics are that 33% of drivers admit to reading or sending text messages while they're driving. Over 3,000 motorists a year are killed in crashes involving distracted drivers. So let's start with the regulation of phone usage, actually talking on the phone. Is that recognized as a form of distraction, or is that thought to be okay, no different than talking to somebody who's in the car with you?
There are a couple of schools of thought about that. I think the prevailing one is that talking on the phone is a form of driver distraction. And the notion is that it's different from talking to someone who's in the seat next to you or maybe in the seat behind you. That person's in the car, they're aware of what's happening in the environment, and so they are going to see that you're stopping suddenly for traffic or you're merging onto the interstate, and so that kind of natural pause in the conversation will occur. Whereas if you're participating in some sort of business call or even a personal cell phone conversation, the person on the other end isn't aware of the situations that you're required to respond to as a driver.
So, and they can't be a second set of eyes for you either in the way that a passenger in the car with you can be. So that kind of concern around distracted driving using phones has led a number of states to require hands-free operation or to limit young drivers' ability to use cell phones while they drive. What have we done in North Carolina?
We have not banned adult drivers from talking on their cell phones with them in their hands. What we have done is prohibit drivers under 18 from using their cell phones at all while they're in the car. So just like the rest of us, they can't text, but they also are not supposed to talk on the phone. There's an exception that allows them to take calls from their parents and to talk to emergency personnel, that sort of thing. In large part, despite the recognized distractions associated with people talking on the phone, we've continued to permit that as a lawful activity.
So how's an officer supposed to know, A, whether a driver is under 18 or over 18, and B, whether they're talking to a parent or a friend?
That's a pretty tough thing for an officer to know. Chapel Hill, a few years ago, tried to enact a broader cell phone ban like the one that applies to novice drivers that would apply to everyone. And the joke that went around was that you just program every number in your phone to say mom or husband so that it would look like you were talking to mom or husband no matter who you were speaking with. So it's pretty near impossible for an officer to know who it is the person's talking to unless the person freely admits, hey, I was just chatting with my friend.
Hey, speaking of Chapel Hill, a couple years ago, Chapel Hill tried to implement that broader ban on cell phone usage, but that was ultimately struck down by the courts, right? Remind us what happened with that.
It was. That was a 2012 ordinance, and at the time it really wasn't unclear whether it wasn't clear whether cities could adopt their own regulations about cell phone use that were stricter than state law. Different provisions of the state law seemed to point to different conclusions in that regard. So Chapel Hill enacted this ordinance, and it quickly, I think actually before it ever went into effect, was challenged by a towing company. And the case went up to the state Supreme Court, and the state Supreme Court said, no, cities do not have the authority to enact these sorts of restrictions. The whole field of cell phone use by drivers is extensively regulated by state law, and it's the state that will decide what those restrictions are.
So local regulations are preempted.
They're out, yes. Okay.
So we've been talking about phone use while driving, but let's talk a little bit now about texting while driving. My recollection is that back in 2009, the General Assembly passed a law making it illegal to text while driving. Is that basically right?
That's right.
So a couple of questions about that. First of all, does the law prohibit reading text messages while a person drives, or just composing or writing text messages while a person drives?
It prohibits both, and it applies to emails, although who in the world emails anymore, but it applies to emails and text messages. So the statute prohibits you from manually entering multiple letters or text in your device if it's for the purpose of communicating with another person. And it also bars drivers from reading emails or text messages.
Okay, so manual entry is out, but can I dictate a text message to Siri and have Siri send the text message to someone else?
I don't know the answer to that. I suppose you can. The question would be whether making Siri do that constitutes a manual entry. I doubt it. So probably you could tell Siri to send text messages to someone while you were driving.
I'm going to rely on that because I do that sometimes. following up on my Apple-based inquiry, what if I have an Apple Watch? The law says that I can't enter things into or read messages on my, quote, mobile telephone. If I'm reading text messages on my watch, am I okay?
No, that's just an extension of your mobile telephone.
Okay, well, let me ask about another electronic device that I might have with me, which might be a laptop computer. Can I read and send emails on my laptop computer while I drive?
No, there's a separate statute that's been around, predates the text messaging statute, that prohibits you from having a computer open in an area of the car where you can see it.
Oh, that's the viewable screen in front of the headrest statute.
Correct.
Okay, I'm tracking now. So what about if I'm stopped at a stoplight? Am I allowed to use my mobile phone to send and receive text messages while I sit there motionless?
I think so. I've been relying on my interpretation that that's permissible. The statute says that the texting ban says that it doesn't apply to a vehicle that is lawfully parked or stopped. And I've got to assume that you're lawfully stopped when you're stopped at a stoplight. And so you can quickly send your text message or read your email while you're in that position.
All right. Last question about the scope and interpretation of the statute. Can I conduct a Google search on my cell phone while I drive?
That depends. What it depends upon is whether at that point your cell phone is like a computer. And if you are entering a Google search into your phone, it starts to look like you are actually using a computer while you're driving.
And does that put us back in the realm of the screen in front of the headrest statue?
Right, right. But what people often do, though, is they enter in an address into their GPS, into the GPS feature in their cell phones. And that seems to clearly be lawful. The texting statute doesn't cover that, and it seems to be the kind of activity that the legislature decided to permit.
Okay, so this brings me back to my question about investigative techniques. It seems like it would be difficult for an officer to know as I zoom down the interstate whether I'm entering an address into my phone for the purpose of accessing a map, or whether I'm dialing numbers to make a phone call, or whether I'm sending a text message. So I'm wondering whether the statute, since it was enacted in 2009, has resulted in many charges.
No. Last year, 1,004 charges for violating the texting while driving statute were issued. So that's not very many when you think about the number of motor vehicle stops that occur in North Carolina and the number of citations overall that are issued. It's really difficult to enforce this unless the violation is noted in connection with some other violation and the person readily admits to texting. It's just not something that's easy for officers to enforce.
Right. Well, compared to the nationwide numbers that say that 660,000 motorists are texting every minute in the United States,
1,000 charges over the course of a year maybe isn't very much. Last question for you on this whole topic, and again, appreciate your time in participating. And looking at what other states have done or how other states have addressed the general question of distracted driving, have you seen any promising or interesting approaches that you think merit at least further consideration here in North Carolina?
Some states have started to look at all of the other things that people do with their cell phones in addition to texting. So Virginia has not adopted, but is right now considering a proposal that prevents a person from selecting multiple icons on their phone. So this kind of legislation would get at things like posting to social media sites and perhaps taking videos while folks are driving down the road, or maybe even if it were drafted broadly enough, could get at taking selfies, using other kinds of features within the phone. So one approach is to try to broaden these bans to include all of the many things that people do with mobile phones. It's slippery, however, because as soon as the legislature bans one particular cell phone activity, another one becomes more popular. If you think back a decade ago, we were really worried about people talking on their phones while they're driving. Nobody uses their phones for phones anymore. Now they text and use other applications. And so I have said before, it reminds me a little bit of trying to regulate the sweepstakes industry. You move from one activity to another, and as soon as one activity becomes unlawful, the other activity is more popular anyway. So it's a tough thing to look at, but states are continuing to try to come up with solutions.
Yeah, the technology always seems to be a step ahead of the law in this type of scenario. I wonder if there's room for an approach that addresses distracted driving at a theoretical level without tying it to any particular technology, and that might cover the other types of instances of distracted driving that we see. Like, I recently was driving down the highway and saw somebody actually reading a novel as they piloted their vehicle down the interstate, or you see people sometimes shaving in their car in the morning, and I wonder whether some more general approach might be possible. What do you think?
Yes, that's old school distraction, and those kinds of distractions have always existed. One thought is that we already have laws that regulate careless and reckless driving, and so to the extent someone's engaging in an activity that poses a danger to others, we have laws that address that. I think the concern here, though, is that cell phone use is so pervasive, and it's not embarrassing to people. If you were driving down the road and shaving and a colleague drove by, you'd probably be kind of embarrassed to be shaving while driving down the road. Maybe the same thing with the novel, and that the mobile phone use has become so pervasive that there isn't much of a stigma associated with doing that while driving. And I think that's another issue that the legislature confronts when it tries to regulate in this area.
Well, we'll leave it at that. Thank you so much for participating in the show.
You're welcome.
This is Jeff Welty back at Podcast Command Central. That concludes this episode of Beyond the Bench. Thanks for listening. We hope you enjoyed it, and if you did, be sure to subscribe to this podcast in iTunes or Stitcher, where you can listen to all of our podcast episodes. Most importantly, please leave us a review. Positive feedback helps other people find out about our show. If you have any topics that you think we should cover or people that you think should be interviewed here on Beyond the Bench, pitch us. We'd love to hear from you. You can email me at welty@sog.unc.edu or producer Danielle Rivenbark at danielle.p@sog.unc.edu. More information about the show is available on the podcast website, podcast.sog.unc.edu. We hope to see you back in 2 weeks with our next episode of Beyond the Bench. That show will include a discussion of judges and lawyers' use of social media with my colleague Chris McLaughlin, and an interview with my colleague Freda Bluestein regarding the legal status of body-worn camera footage. Again, this is your host, Jeff Welty. Podcast adjourned.